Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Fall of Robespierre, 24 Hours in Revolutionary Paris, by Colin Jones, narrated by Sasha Higgins. It wasn't about principles. It was about killing. Marc-Antoine Baudot on the overthrow of Robespierre. Introduction. The Fall of Robespierre, up close. From up close, things are different from when one judges them from afar. Revolutionary crises are composed of infinitely small things, and these form the essential base of all events. In general, there is much about them that will astonish the observer. Nearly all have been not only unanticipated, they fall within the category of things that no wise man can believe possible. The French Revolution, stated Louis-Sébastien Mercier, author, journalist, politician, and matchless commentator on his native Paris in the late 18th century, was all about optics. Only by getting up close and drilling down into infinitely small details of the revolutionary process could one gain a satisfactory understanding of the often improbable and invariably unpredictable course of great revolutionary events. Time seemed to speed up in 1789. Mercier's fellow statesman, Boissy d'Anglas, expressed wonder that, from the vantage point of 1795, it seemed that French men and women had lived 6 centuries in the space of 6 years. Parisians had become keenly aware of time. They lacked bells tolling the hours, following the nationalization of ecclesiastical property and the closure of most churches. But their pockets now contained watches, alongside wallets, handkerchiefs, and snuff boxes. They politely apologized for not giving an exact time if they had forgotten their timepiece. Parisians were never more time alert than on the days of popular action within Paris, the so-called journée, when time seemed to accelerate particularly frenetically. Journées punctuated political life throughout the decade, from 14 July 1789, conventionally held to be the start of the revolution, to 18 Brumaire, 9 November 1799, when the advent of Napoleon is generally seen as marking its end. They seem to follow their own rules and procedures at a headlong pace that could push out of shape and utterly transform the overall course of events in ways that, as Mercier put it, no wise man would believe possible. In order to understand the logic and mechanics of any particular Parisian journée and follow the twists and turns of its course, Mercier's advice was thus to take a microscope and get up close to the action. On a revolutionary journée, he wondered, when every moment seemed to count and be big with consequence, how can one write such a history if one loses track of the sequential narrative, enchaînement, of each day? For such and such an event was produced so unanticipatedly that it seems less to have occurred than to have been created out of nothing. It seemed that each participant was part of an invisible, intricately linked chain leading hectically who knew where. The subject of this book is one of those days of action that so fascinated Mercier. 27 July 1794, or 9 Thermidor Year 2, in the nomenclature of the French Revolutionary Calendar introduced in 1793. He did not supply a full account of it, as at that moment he was a political prisoner, in jail in the former monastery of the Benedictin Anglais, up on the Rue Saint-Jacques on the left bank, fearing for his life. Yet this did not deter him from following, reflecting on and feeling part of the action in all its complexity. The day saw the fall from power of Maximilien Robespierre, one of the revolution's most charismatic and outstanding politicians, and it signalled the beginning of the end for the type of government through terror in which he had played a key part over the previous year. It is a day whose outcome historians invariably view as a kind of parliamentary coup d'état, performed by Robespierre's opponents within the political elite. I hope to show that its outcome was determined not just by politicians' machinations, but also as a result of a huge process of collective action by the people of Paris, who, since 1789, had cut an increasingly significant figure in national politics. In order to understand how the people of Paris achieved its role as one of the significant actors in the drama of the day, we need to understand in outline the city's role within the revolution's history, back to the first revolutionary journée. On 14 July 1789, Parisians famously stormed the Bastille, the notorious state prison and arms dump on the eastern edge of the city. They did so in order to protect themselves against an attempt by King Louis XVI and his ministers to erase the gains the revolution had made thus far. By their actions that day, Parisians forced the king to confirm the creation of a single, unitary National Assembly, and to allow the establishment of a constitutional monarchy grounded in principles to be laid out in the historic Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, promulgated on 26 August 1789. The constitutional monarchy ultimately failed. By the time of another key day of Parisian popular action on 10 August 1792, Louis XVI's huge popularity in 1789 had almost entirely dissipated, and a ruler earlier held as the restorer of French liberties was being compared to despotic tyrants of antiquity. The advent of war against continental Europe in April 1792 played an important part in this turnabout. The king's failure to rally to the flag, even at a moment of utmost national emergency, destroyed his political legitimacy. The Parisian revolt of 10 August obliged the king to step down. He was subsequently tried by a new assembly, the National Convention, elected by universal male suffrage, before being executed in January 1793. The convention underlined the epochal importance of the king's overthrow by declaring retrospectively in October 1793 that the day on which they had voted a republic, 21 September 1792, marked the dawn of an era that would be celebrated in a new way of marking time. Its post-dated inauguration meant that by the time the new calendar got going, year two of the era of equality was already underway. The new calendar, drawing on the decimal system that French scientists regarded as naturally grounded in human reason, divided the year not into weeks, but into 10-day décades. Many of the new decadal days of rest were given over to celebrations and commemorations of various kinds. There were still 12 months, but because the calendar was calculated from 21 September 1792, each started on or around the third week of the old calendar months. A new nomenclature was introduced, replacing the former mishmash of Roman gods and emperors and Christian saints with a system of names evoking states of nature and the rural economy. The new months reflected the climate, at least in the temperate zones of the northern hemisphere. Thermidor was the hot month, from the Greek thermon, for summer heat. It was preceded by Messidor, June to July, the harvest month, Messis, harvest in Latin, May to June, by Prairial, the meadow months, Prairie, Meadow in French, April to May, and by Floreal, the month of flowers, Flos, flower in Latin, March to April. Similarly, each former saint's day was blessed with a name grounded in nature. The date 9 Thermidor, for example, became the day of the mulberry. The 10 August journée that triggered this change in the recording of time had confirmed the people of Paris as a political actor in their own right, in the new republic. Social groups that had been outside or on the fringes of public life hitherto were now held as key elements within a popular movement that expressed itself not simply through armed intervention on journée, but also through political and ideological engagement within expanded parameters of democratic space, now inclusive of newspapers and pamphlets, public meetings and demonstrations, political associations and clubs, as well as the local committees and assemblies within the 48 sections into which, since 1790, Paris had been divided. The leading edge of the popular movement was the group known from 1791 to 2 onwards as sans-culottes, a term which signified that they were without breeches. That is to say that they preferred the trousers of the working man over the breeches that were the normal mark of gentility prior to 1789. In year 2, the sans-culottes came to supply the loudest voices and the most dynamic actors within the popular movement, and they powerfully impacted public opinion. Within this inclusive democratic space, the Paris popular movement aspired to represent the people of France as a whole. This claim was put to the test in the summer and autumn of 1793, however, when most of the rest of the country mounted vigorous protests at what they regarded as unwarranted interference by Parisians in the political process. By 2 further journées, on 31 May and 2 June 1793, the Parisian popular movement joined forces with radical deputies in the convention, known as Montagnards, to expel from the assembly more than a score of moderate deputies, all Girondins. Parisians justified this assault on nationally elected delegates by highlighting the desperate state of the nascent republic's military position, and they accused the Girondins of obstructing a war of national defence. Even as the armies of the Allied powers advanced across French frontiers, provincial protests against the journée swelled dangerously into civil war conditions, with the Federalist Revolt affecting numerous areas across France, particularly in and around the major cities of Lyon, Marseille and Toulon. The security situation was further aggravated by unrest in western France, in and around the Vendée department, in that took on the complexion of a royalist rebellion. The convention overcame all these threats to its existence, military disintegration, federalist revolt, and peasant insurrection in western France, by dint of introducing a state of emergency, which involved the suspension of normal constitutional arrangements, including most of the individual freedoms enshrined within the Rights of Man Declaration. In particular, the deputies created a Committee of Public Safety, composed of 12 deputies, that it set at the heart of what was viewed as a revolutionary government. In this context, revolutionary signified that the state was not operating formally within a constitution. The radical constitution agreed in 1793 was never to be implemented. The committee was endowed with semi-dictatorial emergency powers in order to conduct the fight against external and internal threats. This notably took the form of terror, the intimidation and disciplining of internal dissidents by the exertion through multiple channels of state violence. The committee's formidable iron fist was intermittently encased with a velvet glove. In particular, the government favoured socially and economically progressive policies that would attach not just Parisian sans-culottes, but the popular classes across the nation to the cause of the Republic. This was the central plank of a strategic alliance struck in the summer of 1793 between the Montagnard deputies in the convention and the sans-culottes of the Parisian popular movement. The alliance was brokered by Maximilien Robespierre, who in July 1793 became a key member of the Committee of Public Safety. More than any other political figure, Robespierre grasped that the legitimation of the revolutionary government's rule through terror would best be achieved by a matching commitment to social reforms that mobilised the nation in general, and Parisians in particular. Robespierre's ideological validation played a major part in the government's seizure of the political and military initiative in the course of 1793-4, in ways that ended civil warfare and gave French armies the edge over their European foes. One might therefore have expected Robespierre to take much personal credit from the great watershed victory in the Battle of Fleurus on 26 June 1794, which relieved the French northern frontier and opened up the Low Countries to the advance of the Republican armies. In fact, for reasons we will explore in the course of the book, this was not at all the case. The relationship between different forces and figures within the revolutionary government had altered in telling ways. Robespierre was at daggers drawn with his colleagues within the revolutionary government, had partially withdrawn from public life, and seemed to be stirring up dissent within Paris against the very government of which he was a member. His behaviour tested the patience of his colleagues in government to the extreme, and ultimately it snapped. On 9 Thermidor, they launched a frontal attack on Robespierre in the convention and placed him under arrest. To understand 9 Thermidor, we will need to comprehend Robespierre's position and motivations, as well as those of the men within the convention who passed from being his allies to his antagonists. But we also must penetrate into the minds and preoccupations of the people of Paris. For, ultimately, it was the action of Parisians that, after many of the sudden ups and downs that for Mercier were characteristic of such journée, determined the outcome of the day. Although the issues of 9 Thermidor were of national scale in their importance, they were settled by Parisians, entre murs. Mercier once quipped that Paris is so big that one could stage a battle at one end of it without the other end knowing anything about it. This was emphatically not the case on 9 Thermidor, however. There was popular involvement and mobilisation in every one of the city's 48 sections. Furthermore, because the day occurred so unexpectedly and passed so swiftly, there was no chance for the environs, let alone the whole of France, to become involved. Most of France woke up on 10 Thermidor to find that Robespierre had fallen. It was the most Parisian of revolutionary journées. Seeing how Parisians, sans-culottes certainly, but many others too, came together to act collectively on 9 Thermidor, involves not just digging down to the level of infinitely small details, but also locating those details within the city, both spatially and temporally, situating the action on the map and by the clock, so to speak. The outcome of the journée depended on decisions made in the course of these 24 hours by hosts of individuals caught up at all levels of the drama and at key moments in the flux of the day. We can grasp the flow of the day best by tracking news and information, and also rumour, gossip, emotions, orders and decrees, men and women, horses, guns, pikes, and cannon, as they travelled within and around the city over these 24 hours. From the most elevated through to the most humble city dweller, and across Paris from the historic heart to its furthermost periphery, Parisians sought to read the runes and to comprehend the minutiae of the day so as to determine their best course of action. How should they act? And for whom? To mobilise or not to mobilise? To rally to Robespierre and the Commune, the municipal government, or to support the National Convention? The day's outcome depended on a million micro-decisions made by Parisians across the expanse of the city and through the 24 hours of the day. Writing the kind of microscopic, multi-layered and multi-perspectival history of Paris and Parisians that this book attempts is only possible because of archival documentation for the day is quite exceptionally rich, allowing us to access literally hundreds and hundreds of micro-narratives that cover fragments of the day from a multitude of angles. For fuller discussions, see Note on Sources, pages 533-6, and Jones, 2014, The Overthrow, pages 696-7. There is a copy of the Barat instruction in W500D3. It would be difficult to think of another day in the whole of the 18th century on which sources are so copious and dense. A few days after the event, Barat, the deputy whom the government charged with the security of the city, initiated a punctiliously thorough review of everything that had happened within each of the 48 sections on 8, 9 and 10 Thermidor. "Gather together all details," he instructed sectional authorities. "A fact that seems minor may illuminate a suspicion or lead to the discovery of a useful truth. Inform me of all orders that you gave and all that you received. But above all, be precise on the dates and the hours. You will appreciate their importance." This call engendered nearly 200 micro-accounts of at least part of the day from vantage points all over the city. Many of these were broken down for key periods of the day into quarter-hourly chunks. Besides this capital source deriving from the Barat inquiry, the convention also set up an official commission to make a report on the day, which was presented in the convention exactly a year later. In addition, newspaper reports and later political memoirs invariably contain accounts of the day. And finally, literally hundreds of individual police dossiers over the next year or so also provide similar micro-accounts of episodes and moments of the day. This mosaic of thousands of fragments of experience distilled and of minutiae remembered composed a drama that seemed larger than real life. When events become at once terrible and singular, in this way, they produce, Mercier noted, a situation in which even dramatic fiction would be far from matching historical facts. The 9 Thermidor proved a day when fact proved, if not stranger than fiction, certainly as gripping and surprising. Changing our customary focus as historians so as to get up close to Parisians, their city, and their actions in the drama of 9 Thermidor allows us to view in a new and unexpected light not only Robespierre, the revolution, the uses of terror, and the people of Paris, but also the way in which we write the history of an epochal event. Prelude. Around midnight. Rue Sfield's lodgings, Rue Saint-Honoré, Tuileries. Pierre-Henri Rue Sfield rents a room above an inn on the Rue Saint-Honoré. Until recently, the street featured on the crowd-lined itinerary for tumbrils, or carts, bearing convicted counter-revolutionaries to the guillotine at the nearby Place de la Révolution. People still gather here in droves. It is one of Paris's liveliest and most urbane thoroughfares. It is also only a short walk to the heart of government in the Tuileries Palace complex. It is an excellent place of residence for politicians, as also for government spies. Rousseville follows the latter vocation. He is an official government observer who reports to the CPS, the Committee of Public Safety. Tonight, Rousseville is putting the final touches to a confidential report for his masters. His report, headed Liberty, Equality, Fraternity, Probity, or Death, is addressed CR. This designates the citizen representatives, the elected deputies, representatives of the people who compose the CPS. But Rousseville is pretty sure that his report will pass before the eyes of another CR, namely Citizen Robespierre. Maximilien Robespierre, the most prominent member of that committee, is Rousseville's main point of contact within the CPS. His lodgings at 366 Rue Saint-Honoré are only a short distance from Rousseville's. Like many spies, Rousseville has a checkered past. A priest prior to 1789, he flirted with the royalist cause as a secret agent in the early years of the revolution before undergoing radicalization. Elected parish priest at Belleville on the northeast edge of Paris, he attended the famous Jacobin Club, France's premier political association, and became linked to the far-left groupings who waged war on Christianity. He published a de-Christianizing pamphlet urging the marriage of priests before practicing what he preached and taking wedding vows. He went on to have spells as government commissary on the Eastern Front in Alsace and as police agent for the Ministry of the Interior and for the Paris departmental authorities before, in early 1794, he secured employment with the CPS. Since its creation by convention decree in April 1793, the CPS has been struggling to stave off military disaster and domestic implosion. It is authorised to conduct the war effort in which France has been engaged since April 1792 by all available means, including powerful authoritarian attacks on anyone who opposes the government line. Through terror, that is. War had helped trigger the overthrow of the monarchy and the creation of a republic in late 1792, but it was also threatening to bring that republic crashing to the ground. In its work, the committee cooperates closely with the CGS, Committee of General Security, which controls security and police matters. These two committees of government, as they are called, each composed of 12 deputies, form the core of the revolutionary government ruling France. Making common cause, the 24 men have achieved great success, crushing waves of internal rebellion and expelling invading foreign armies. In the Battle of Fleurus a month before, on 26 June 1794, French forces inflicted a major defeat on their Austrian foes, opening up the Low Countries to French advance. Despite their record of joint success, there are ideological and personal issues causing friction between the two committees of government. These are getting worse and have started to threaten government stability. One deep line of fracture is over policing. Robespierre, Rousseville's handler on the CPS, is highly critical of CGS agents. The CGS believes that in order to catch a thief, one sometimes has to set a thief. It employs individuals who do not seem as squeakily virtuous and patriotically clean as Robespierre would wish. The CGS's spy chief, Jean-Baptiste Dossonville, is a case in point. The bar that he ran in 17...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?